This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents The Crooked Staircase, a Jane Hawke novel by Dean Koontz, performed by Elizabeth Rogers. To Vito and Lynn, with love, for all the laughter. A shattering of shop windows, the bomb in the baby carriage, was wired to the radio. These are the days of miracle and wonder, and don't cry, baby, don't cry, don't cry. Paul Simon, The Boy in the Bubble. Hateful empty masks, full of beetles and spiders, yet glaring out from their glass eyes with a ghastly affectation of life. Thomas Carlyle, Sartor Resartus. Part 1. Nowhere safe. 1. At 7 o'clock on that night in March, during a thunderless but heavy rain pounding as loud as an orchestra of kettle drums, Sarah Holdsteck finally left the offices of Paradise Real Estate, carrying her briefcase in her left hand, open purse slung over her left shoulder, right hand free for a crossbody draw of the gun in the purse. She boarded her Ford Explorer, threw back the dripping hood of her raincoat, and drove home by way of familiar suburban streets on which the foul weather had settled a strangeness, an apocalyptic gloom that matched her mood. Not for the first time in the past 2 years, she felt as if somewhere ahead of her, reality itself must be eroding, washing away, so that she might come to the crumbling edge of a precipice with nothing beyond but a lightless, bottomless abyss. Silver needles of rain pleated the darkness with mystery and threat. Any vehicle that followed her more than 3 blocks elicited her suspicion. The Springfield Armory Champion 45 ACP was nestled in her open purse, which stood on her briefcase, within easy reach on the passenger seat. Originally, she hadn't wanted a weapon of such a high caliber, but she had eventually realized that nothing smaller would so reliably stop an assailant. She had spent many hours on a shooting range, learning to control the recoil. She had once lived in a gated community with an around-the-clock security guard in a paid-off 12,000-square-foot residence with a view of the Pacific Ocean. Now, she owned a house 1/4 that size, encumbered by a fat mortgage in a neighborhood with no gate, no guard, no view. Starting with little money, by the age of 40 she had built a modest fortune as a Southern California real estate agent, broker, and canny investor. But most of it had been taken from her by the time she was 42. At 44, though bitter, she was nonetheless grateful that she hadn't been rendered penniless. Having clawed her way to the top once before, she'd been left with just enough assets to start the climb again. This time, she would not make the mistake that had led to her ruin. She would not marry. On the street where Sarah lived, storm runoff overwhelmed the drains to form shallow lakes wherever the pavement swaled. Her Ford cast up wings of water in a false promise of magical flight. She slowed and swung into her driveway. Lights glowed in some windows, controlled by a smart house program that, after nightfall and in her absence, created the illusion of occupancy and activity. She remoted the garage door and, while it rolled up on its tracks, put her open purse in her lap. She drove inside, the drumming of rain on the roof relenting as the welcome electronic shriek of the alarm system inspired a greater sense of safety than she had felt since setting out for work that morning. She did not switch off the engine. With the doors still locked, she kept her left foot hard on the brake, her right poised over the accelerator, and she shifted into reverse. She used the remote control again and looked from one of the SUV's side mirrors to the other, watching the big segmented door descend. If someone tried to slip in under it, the motion detector would sense the intruder and, as a safety measure, retract the door. If that happened, the instant the roll-up cleared the roof of the Explorer, she would take her foot off the brake, stomp the accelerator, and reverse at speed into the driveway, into the street. With luck, she might be quick enough to run down whatever son of a bitch had come after her. The bottom rail of the door met the concrete with a soft thud. She was alone in the garage. She shifted the SUV into park, applied the emergency brake, switched off the engine, and got out. The last exhaust fumes threaded the air. The Ford shed rain on the concrete floor and ticked as the engine cooled. After unlocking the connecting door to the house, she stepped into the laundry room, turned to the keypad, and entered the 4-number code that disarmed the security system. At once, she reset the alarm to the at-home mode, which activated only the sensors at the doors and windows, leaving dormant the interior motion detectors, allowing her to move freely through the residence. She hung her raincoat on a wall hook, where it dripped onto the tile floor. Purse slung from her left shoulder, briefcase in her right hand, she opened the inner laundry room door and went into the kitchen, realizing, an instant too late, that the air was redolent with the aroma of freshly brewed coffee. A stranger with a pistol stood at the dinette table on which rested a mug of coffee and Sarah's copy of that morning's Los Angeles Times, with its banner headline, "Jane Hawk Indicted for Espionage, Treason, Murder." The barrel of the weapon was elongated by a silencer, the muzzle as dark and deep as a wormhole connecting this universe to another. Sarah halted, shocked, not merely because her home had been violated in spite of all her precautions, but also because the intruder was a woman. 20-something, with long black hair parted mid-forehead and tucked behind her ears, with eyes as black and direct as the muzzle of the gun, with no makeup or lipstick, and no need of any, wearing wire-rimmed glasses, dressed in a black sport coat and a white shirt and black jeans, she looked severe and yet beautiful and somehow unearthly, as if death had undergone an image makeover and at long last revealed her true gender. "I'm not here to hurt you," the intruder said. "I just need some information. But first, put your purse on the counter and don't reach for the gun in it." Although Sarah suspected that it would be foolish to hope to deceive this woman, she heard herself say, "Whatever you are, I'm not like you. I'm just a real estate agent. I don't have a gun." The stranger said, "2 years ago you purchased a Springfield Armory super-tuned champion with a Novak low-mount fixed sight, polished extractor and ejector and feed ramp, and a King extended safety. You ordered it with an A1-style trigger precisely tuned to a 4-pound pull, and you had the entire weapon carry-beveled, all its edges and corners rounded so that it won't snag during a quick draw. You must have done a lot of research to come up with an order like that, and you must have spent many hours on a shooting range learning to handle the piece, because then you applied for and received a concealed carry permit." Sarah put the purse on the counter. "The briefcase, too," the intruder directed. "Don't even think of slinging it at me." When she did as told, Sarah's gaze fixed on a nearby drawer that held cutlery, including a French chef's knife and a cleaver. "Unless you're a champion knife thrower," the stranger said, "you'll never be fast enough to use it." "Didn't you hear me say I don't mean you any harm?" Sarah turned from the cutlery drawer. "Yeah, I heard. But I don't believe it." The woman regarded her in silence for a moment, and then said, "If you're as smart as I think you are, you'll warm up to me. If you're not that smart, this will get ugly when it doesn't need to be. Sit down at the table." "What if I just walk out of here?" "Then I'll have to hurt you a little after all. But you'll have brought it on yourself." The intruder's face, the strength of its features, the clarity of its lines, its refinement, was as purely Celtic as any face in Scotland or Ireland, but those eyes, so black that the pupils and irises were as one, seemed to belong in a different countenance. The contrast was somehow unsettling, as if the face might be a mask, its every expression unreliable, while the truth that otherwise might be read in her eyes remained secreted in their darkness. Although Sarah had promised herself that she would never again be intimidated by anyone, after a brief staring match, she sat where she'd been told to sit. 2. The tropical stillness of the storm succumbed to a sudden wind that cast shatters of rain against the windows. Jane Hawke sat across from Sarah Holdsteck and put her Heckler & Koch 45 compact on the kitchen table. Sarah looked weary, which was not surprising, considering all that she had been through in the past 2 years. Weary, but not defeated. Jane was familiar with that condition. Your Springfield champion is a sweet weapon, Sarah, but don't carry it in your purse. Change the way you dress. Get in the habit of wearing a sport coat. Carry the gun in a concealed shoulder rig where you can draw it quickly. I hate guns. It was a big step for me just to get one. I understand. But switch to a shoulder rig anyway. And get real about security systems like the one you had installed here. Skirling wind rattled rain hard against the glass, disquieting Sarah, so that she looked at each of the 2 kitchen windows as if she expected to see some face of inhuman configuration conjured by the storm. Returning her attention to Jane, she said, "Get real about my security system? What's that mean?" "Do you know that all alarm companies in any city or region use the same central station to monitor the systems they install?" "I thought each company monitored its own." "Not the case. And certain government agencies have secret, basically illegal, back doors to all those central stations across the country. Do you understand what I mean by back doors? A way into the company's computer the company doesn't know about? I used a back door to your security provider and reviewed your account, learned where your alarm keypads and motion detectors are located, the password you use when you accidentally trigger an alarm and call in a cancellation, the location of the battery that backs up the system during a power failure. Useful stuff for any bad guy to know, though he'd still need the 4-digit disarming code." 2 words belatedly brought a scowl to Sarah's face. "Government agencies? I've had enough of them. Which are you with?"
"None. Not anymore. Sarah, the alarm company isn't supposed to have that disarming code. It's something only the homeowner should know. You should program it yourself with the primary keypad. But, like a lot of people, you didn't want to bother following the steps in the manual, so you asked the installer to program it for you. Which he did. And noted it in your account file, where I found it."
As if the weight of her mistake pressed on her, Sarah slumped lower in her chair. "I've been living defensively for a long time, but I don't claim to be perfect at it."
"Maybe you need to be better, but you don't want to be perfect at it. Only the insane are perfect in their paranoia."
"Sometimes I think I've already gone half crazy the way I live. I mean, the worst happened more than 2 years ago. Nothing since. But in your gut, you know, at any time he might decide you're a loose end that needs to be tied off." Sarah glanced again at the windows.
"Would you like to lower the blinds?" Jane asked.
"I always do want to come home after dark."
"Go ahead. Then sit down again."
Having closed the blinds, Sarah returned to her chair. Jane said, "I got in here using an automatic lock-picking gun, supposedly sold only to police. Turned off the alarm with your code, reset it in the at-home mode, and settled down to wait."
"I'll change the code myself."
"But who are you?"
Instead of answering, Jane said, "You are on top of the world, selling high-end houses, damn good at it, never a complaint from a client. Then,
Suddenly, you're hit with three very public lawsuits, all within 2 weeks, alleging fraudulent activities.
The allegations weren't true.
I'm aware of that. Then came a seemingly unrelated IRS audit, but not an ordinary audit, one conducted with the assumption of criminal intent, accusations of money laundering. The memory triggered indignation that drew Sarah up straight in her chair. The IRS agents who came to pore through my books, they were armed, as if I was some dangerous terrorist. Armed auditors aren't supposed to flaunt their weapons.
Yeah, well, they made damn sure I knew they were packing.
To intimidate you. Sarah squinted, as if to focus more intently on Jane's face.
Do I know you? Have we met before?
Doesn't matter, Sarah. What matters is that I despise the same people you despise.
Like, who would that be?
From a jacket pocket, Jane produced a photograph of Simon Yegg and dealt it across the table, as if it were a playing card.
My husband, Sarah said. Ex-husband. The vicious shit.
I know why I despise him, but why do you? Because of the crew he hangs with. I want to use him to get to them. In the process, I can make him profoundly sorry he did to you what he did. I can humble him. 3. Tanuja Shukla was standing in the deep front yard, in the rain and the dark, soaked and chilled and lonely and wildly happy, when the assassins arrived. Although, of course, she didn't at once realize they were assassins. 25 and obsessively creative from early childhood, Tanuja had been writing a novelette in which a rain-drenched night provided atmosphere, but also served as a metaphor for loneliness and spiritual malaise. After watching the downpour from a window of her second-floor study, she seized the opportunity to immerse herself in the elements, the better to know what her lead character felt during a long journey on foot in a storm. Other writers of literary fiction with elements of fantasy found most research unnecessary, but Tanuja believed that a skeleton of truth needed to provide the structure underlying an author's muscular invention, the fantasy, and that the two must be bound together by tendons of accurate facts and well-observed details. Her twin brother, Sanjay, who was 2 minutes younger than Tanuja and considerably more acerbic, had said, "Don't worry. When you die of pneumonia, I'll finish writing your story and the last pages will be the best of it." Tanuja's jeans and black t-shirt were saturated, at first clinging like one of those weighted blankets meant to alleviate anxiety, but then seeming to dissolve so that she felt as if she were unclothed except for her blue sneakers, naked in the storm, vulnerable and alone. Exactly how the character in her novelette felt. As she mentally catalogued the physical details of this experience for later use in fiction, she was more content than she had been all day. The house stood at the end of a 2-lane road on 3 acres in the eastern hills of Orange County horse country, though there were no longer horses on this acreage. White-painted wire-infilled board fencing encircled the property. 60 or 70 yards west of the house, a gate of the same materials barred entrance to the long driveway. The stormfall drummed the earth and chattered like an infinite number of tumbling dice against the blacktop, and on a nearby 100-year-old live oak, each of the thousands of stiff oval-shaped leaves was a tongue that gave voice to the rain, raising a chorus of whispers that together were like the roar of a distant crowd, all serving to mask the sound of an approaching engine. Because the Shukla place was the last residence before the blacktop dead-ended in a turnaround, the light approaching from the south tweaked Tanuja's curiosity. No visitor was expected. In the murk, the seemingly soundless conveyance appeared to be borne on a tide of mist that roiled off the pavement, headlights chasing before them flocks of shadows that winged across eucalyptus trees on the farther side of the 2-lane road. The vehicle halted at the gate. not facing inward but athwart the driveway, as though to block that exit from the property. When doors were thrown open, interior lights came on, defining the proportions of a large SUV. The driver doused the headlights, and when the last door closed, the vehicle as good as vanished. Tanuja had stood so long in the deluge that her eyes were fully dark-adapted. Because the plank gate was painted white, she could see it even at that distance, less as a gate than as some pale and cryptic symbol, a mysterious hieroglyph floating portentously on the night. She also discerned three half-visible figures clambering over that barrier. Outside of the gate stood a call box on a post. Visitors were meant to press a button and announce themselves, whereupon the gate could be opened from the house. But these new arrivals eschewed the call box and instead climbed the planking, suggested they were not visitors, but intruders bent on mischief, or worse. In her dark clothes, with her black hair and maiden of Mumbai complexion, Tanuja would be difficult to spot as long as she avoided the outspill of light from the house. She turned and dashed to the massive oak, which gathered rain and channeled it along leafways, from which it drizzled in 100 thick streams. She paused and glanced back and saw three big men hurrying up the driveway, their hooded jackets and determined stride suggesting satanic monks abroad on some infernal task. Hers was not a life of high drama, other than the scenarios that arose in her mind and found expression in her writing. She had not before experienced such hard pounding of the heart as shook her now, as if contained within her breast were both hammer and anvil. She sprinted from the oak and around the south side of the house, staying clear of the light from the windows. Onto the back porch. Two doors. The first opened into the kitchen, the second into the mudroom, but of course both were locked. She fumbled a key from a pocket, dropped it, snatched it from the porch floor, and let herself into the mudroom, where she had left her smartphone before venturing into the storm. Slender and athletic, Tanuja was usually as graceful as a dancer, but now, shedding rainwater, she slipped on the vinyl tile flooring and fell. A door on the left connected the mudroom to the kitchen, and one directly ahead accessed the downstairs hallway. She thrust to her feet, sodden shoes slipping as if she were a skater on ice, and opened the door and saw Sanjay. He had stepped out of his study and gone into the foyer at the farther end of the hallway, where he'd just now opened the front door. Too late to call out a warning, Tanuja hoped that she had misread the situation, that her overactive imagination had invoked menace where none existed. The first man at the door was known to her, Lincoln Crossley, who lived two houses south of them, a deputy with the sheriff's department. Link was married to Kendra, who worked as a bailiff at the county courthouse. They had a 16-year-old son, Jeff, and a Labrador retriever named Gustav. They were good people. And for a moment, Tanuja was relieved. Rather than wait for an invitation, however, Crossley and the two men behind him crossed the threshold the moment the door opened, crowding Sanjay backward, their boldness disturbing. None of them wore a uniform, and whoever the two strangers might be, Crossley's behavior was not protocol for an officer of the law. Tanuja couldn't discern what Link Crossley said or what Sanjay answered, though she heard the deputy speak her name. She eased the mudroom door almost shut, watching through a narrow gap, feeling like a child, a small, uncomprehending girl who by accident stood witness to a mysterious and disquieting adult encounter. Crossley put one arm around Sanjay's shoulders, but in that move, Tanuja read some quality darker than neighborly affection. He was much bigger than Sanjay. One of Crossley's associates drew a pistol, quickly crossed the foyer and ascended the stairs, apparently with no concern that his boots and jacket streamed water on the carpet and the hardwood floor. When the third man closed the front door, stepped out of the foyer, and disappeared into the parlor as though on a search, Tanuja opened a drawer in a mudroom cabinet, retrieved a flashlight, grabbed her phone from a countertop, and fled. She crossed the porch, vaulted the railing, and hurried across the backyard into the wind and rain, not daring yet to switch on the light, her fertile imagination spawning terrors of extreme violence and rape and intolerable humiliation, even as it also crafted desperate scenes in which she might, by various means, save herself and her brother. 4. Long, lingering resentment pinched Sarah Holdsteck's mouth and pinked her cheeks, the knuckles bone-white in her clenched fists, as she spoke about what she'd endured more than 2 years earlier, when she'd been sued by 3 clients in 1 week, which turned out to be the least of the assaults against her. Because the woman's anguish at having been betrayed and played for a fool had not faded with time, Jane found it painful to watch her. Sarah's attorney of 15 years, Mary Wyatt, had assured her that those legal actions were frivolous, that among the accusers there was an appearance of collusion with intent to defame, and that she should not worry unduly. 3 days later, with no explanation, Mary dropped her as a client and declined to accept her phone calls. Another attorney took her on, and the following day changed his mind. While a third lawyer tried to persuade her to settle the suits out of court, a 6-unit apartment building that she owned appeared on an EPA list of structures standing on ground contaminated by highly toxic chemicals, and 3 days thereafter, she received a health department summons to appear at a hearing into the dangers faced by tenants of her property. By this time, IRS auditors had been in the offices of her accountant for 6 business days, examining her books in search of evidence of money laundering. Now, she poked a finger at the photo of Simon Yegg on the table in front of her. It was a Friday evening. This treacherous snake sat me down for what he called a come-to-Jesus meeting. He claimed my problems were the work of friends of his who he wouldn't name. The smug bastard wanted a divorce. He gave me a property division ultimatum. He'd keep everything he brought into the marriage just 18 months earlier and take 70% of my assets, graciously leaving me start-over money. In return, he'd make the lawsuits go away, have the IRS audit conclude quickly in my favor, and get the apartments taken off the list of contaminated sites. You believed he could do all that? Jane asked. Everything happening to me was so bizarre, surreal. I didn't know what to believe. The change in him was shocking. He'd always been so sweet, so loving. Suddenly he was condescending, cruel, contemptuous of me. I told him to get out. I said it was my house before we were married and it would always be my house. What happened to make you back down? Sarah looked at one blinded window and then at the other, not because anything of the night could be seen, but perhaps because she was embarrassed to meet Jane's eyes. I didn't know he had 3 people with him. They came in from the garage. 2 men and a woman. He gave me to them. And he left. Gave you to them? Sarah opened her fists, regarding her hands as if repulsed by some filth that only she could see. The men held me down. After a silence, Jane said, "Rape." "No." They stripped me naked, cuffed my hands, indifferent, as if I wasn't a woman to them. Not a person, just a thing. Her voice had gone flat, deflated of all emotion, as if she had so often examined this memory that she'd worn away its sharp edges and its ability to distress her. But the truth of its enduring effect could be seen in the paleness of her lips, the color burning in her cheeks, and the stiffening of her body as if in defense against a hard blow. "They took me to a bathroom," she continued in a voice eerily detached from the cruelty she described. The woman had filled the tub with cold water, also with ice, cubes from the kitchen ice maker, a lot of ice. They forced me to sit in the tub. Hypothermia is an effective torture, Jane said. Iranians use it. North Koreans. Cubans. When they don't want to mark the victim.
One man sat on the toilet. One brought a chair.
The woman sat on the tub. Edge of the tub. They talked movies, TV, sports. Like I wasn't there. If I spoke, she zapped my neck with a taser, then held my head out of the water by my hair till the spasms stopped. How long did this go on? I lost track of time. But it wasn't just one session. They did it to me on and off all weekend. Jane listed some symptoms of hypothermia. Uncontrollable shivering, confusion, weakness, dizziness, slurred speech. Cold is its own kind of pain, Sarah said. She closed her eyes and bent her head, and might have been mistaken for a woman in prayer if her hands had not cramped into fists once more. Jane waited in patient quiet, Sarah in the chilly silence of mortification, until Jane said, It wasn't primarily about the pain. Sure, they wanted you to be miserable and afraid, but mainly it was about humiliation, making you feel helpless, submissive, using shame to break your resolve. When at last Sarah spoke, her voice trembled as if the needled cold of that long-ago ordeal pricked her bones again. The men? When they had to. Jane spared her from the need to say it. When they had to urinate, they did it in the tub. Finally, Sarah raised her head and met Jane's eyes. I never could have imagined such a thing, treating anyone with such contempt. Because you'd never dealt with their type before. I have. The character of the tremor in Sarah's voice changed. No longer occasioned by a memory of cold or humiliation, but by a virulent and righteous anger. Will you do to Simon what those three did to me? I don't work that way, Sarah. He deserves it. He deserves worse. Will you ruin him?
Possibly.
Take his money?
Some of it, anyway.
Will you kill him?
If I force him to tell me what I need to know, other people will probably kill him for ratting on them.
Sarah considered that prospect. What's this all about?
You don't want to know. But if you hope to get your self-respect back, entirely back, you need to help me.
Outside, rain and wind. In the mind of Sarah Holdsteck, a different but equal turbulence. Then she said, What do you want to know? 5. Tanuja Shukla, thrashed by fear but driven by duty, owing her brother no less than everything, hurrying through the dark stable where no horses had been kept for years, putting the flashlight with her left hand, even though distance and foul weather made it unlikely that one of the men in the house, glancing out a window, would glimpse the pale beam. Rain beating on the roof like the booted feet of marching legions, the earthen scent of the hard-packed hoof-imprinted floor, the musty but sweet smell of old straw moldering in the corners of the empty stalls. What had once been the tack room, where saddles and bridles and other horse gear had been stored, now contained a riding lawnmower, rakes and spades and gardening tools. A long-handled axe could serve as a weapon, but it wouldn't be enough to help one slender girl drive off or chop down three men, even if she had the stomach for such violence, which she didn't. Because the tack room was without windows, she no longer hooded the flashlight beam. She swept it quickly across bags of fertilizer, terracotta pots of all sizes, redwood stakes for tomato plants, cans of spectracide wasp and hornet killer. From the shelf, she took a container of hornet spray, removed the safety cap. The can was about 10 inches tall, weighed maybe a pound and a half. It contained a lot of poison. A cadenced wind now brought complex rhythms to the rain as Tanuja returned to the open door of the stable, where she switched off the flashlight and put it on the floor. Hindu by birth, but not by practice, she had not believed in the faith of her mother and father since she'd been 10, which was the year they perished in the crash of a 747 while on a flight from New Delhi to London. Yet now, she sent up a prayer to Bhavani, the goddess who was the benign aspect of the fierce Shakti. Bhavani, the giver of life and the great font of mercy. Provide me with strength and allow me to triumph. She plunged into the cold rain, vigorously shaking the can of spectracide as she ran toward the house where Sanjay was perhaps in mortal danger. Sanjay had slid into existence and taken his first breath close behind her, following her from womb to wicked world. Therefore, she must always be his rakshak, his protector. 6. A crystal bull, like a gypsy's instrument of foretelling that had failed to predict the current threat, seemed to float on the translucent milky quartz tabletop, bright with a fullness of ripe roses that shed petals as portentous as blood drops. Sitting at the kitchen table, held there at gunpoint, Sanjay Shukla was both fearful and exhilarated. He was sufficiently self-aware to marvel that, in such dire circumstances, a thread of delight was woven through his dread. His sister wrote a kind of magic realism, and her new novel, only in stores 3 weeks, had earned all but universal critical acclaim. Sanjay, too, had been declared an author of promise for importing into the literary novel certain qualities of hard-boiled detective stories. Sometimes he worried that he'd not experienced enough of the dangers and roughness of the world to be able to write neo-noir fiction as effectively as he wished. Yet his parents had died when terrorists blew up an airplane. Yes, his and Tanuja's Mausi, their mother's sister, Aunt Ashima Chatterjee, and her husband Bert, during their guardianship of the Shukla twins, had embezzled 2/3 of the inheritance before their niece and nephew could induce a court to declare them adults at the age of 17. But none of that was the kind of noir ordeal that would have made a good movie with Robert Mitchum. Therefore, Sanjay often wished that he had more gritty experience of threat and violence. Now, here he was, staring down the barrel of a pistol held by a neighbor who previously seemed as straight arrow as Captain America. A second gunman, a stranger, stood near the door to the mudroom. A third man, whose caterpillar eyebrows nearly met over the bridge of his nose, placed on the table a small cooler from which he produced a packaged hypodermic needle with cannula and a stainless steel box about 9 inches square, 7 or 8 inches deep. He handled the box with cotton gloves, evidently because it was cold enough to take the skin off bare fingers. Sanjay was less alarmed by the pistol than by the syringe. A gun was an easily understood threat, but the needle injected an element of the unknown. It made him think of illness, disease. He wasn't sick, and even if he had been, these men were not here to heal him, which meant they might be here to infect him. That made no sense. But people did a lot of things that made no sense. Sanjay also thought of truth serum, movie scenes involving interrogation, but that didn't compute either, because he didn't have any valuable information to withhold from anyone. He had asked them what they wanted, what they were doing, what this was all about, but they had ignored his questions, even though he answered theirs. Maybe they intuited that his answers were not truthful, which was why they responded to his inquiries only with silence. He'd told them that Tanuja was on a date with her boyfriend and that he didn't know when they would return. He hoped that his sister, who didn't currently have a boyfriend, who had been outside somewhere, standing in the rain, engaged in one of her eccentric quests for authentic details to enhance her writing, had seen these men coming, realized their malicious intent, and gone for help. Because conducting an agitated, one-sided conversation would only make him seem desperate and likely to make a break for freedom, Sanjay matched their silence with silence and slumped in the chair, as if sliding into hopelessness, just a skinny Indian boy with a pair of goalies no bigger than chickpeas, if he had any goalies at all between his legs. The more certain they were that he'd submitted to them, the more likely he might surprise them and escape. The man wearing gloves opened the metal box, from which wafted a pale, odorless mist, as if perhaps the contents rested on a bed of dry ice that began to evaporate when exposed to the air. The guns and syringe were frightening, but the shared attitude of the three intruders was even more intimidating. The sense of authority with which they invaded the house and forcibly escorted Sanjay to the kitchen and pressed him into this chair and pushed aside the bowl of roses, slopping water on the quartz. The arrogant silence with which they responded to his protests and questions. Their faces, without expression. Their stares, direct and pitiless, as though they regarded him as belonging to a different and inferior species from them. Link Crossley was not himself, lacking his usual humor, and there was something machine-like about all of them. The metal box appeared to contain numerous sleeves of silvery insulation, each perhaps an inch in diameter and 7 inches long. As the gloved man removed three of these and put them on the table, his frown brought his caterpillar eyebrows together as if in an act of bristling conjugation. Crossley put his pistol on the counter by the refrigerator and from a jacket pocket produced a length of rubber tubing of the kind that phlebotomists used as a tourniquet to make it easier to find the vein of a patient from whom blood was to be drawn. The unhurried movements of the mute and solemn men, like mimes, engaged not in entertainment but in the conveyance of some truth with a terrible consequence. Razor-keen light gleaming off the edges of the stainless steel box as it was pressed shut. A few last feathery emissions from the smoking ice, as ephemeral as the secrets of the deceased issuing from the death-throttled throats of spirits. Moment by moment, the scene became more dreamlike, yet hyper-real in its detail. The gun on the counter seemed to be an opportunity. If Sanjay chose the right moment when the men were distracted, twisted his chair to the left, reared back from the table, bolted up, moved fast, he surely could reach the pistol before the deputy seized it, though it was important to remember that Link had police training. Crossley also produced a foil packet that might have contained an alcohol-saturated pad to sterilize the skin before pricking it with a needle. Sanjay's attention was drawn again to the three silvery tubes. Caterpillar Man peeled open the Velcro closure on one, and into his hand slid a glass ampule containing a cloudy amber fluid. The fragile thread of delight woven through Sanjay's dread had withered away. In the past few minutes, he had experienced enough threat and violence to inspire his writing for the rest of his career, assuming that he lived long enough to have one. As Caterpillar Man pierced the membrane of the ampule with the needle and drew the amber fluid into the barrel of the syringe, the man standing near the mudroom holstered his gun and approached, perhaps to restrain Sanjay should that be necessary. He yawned, as though he must be so experienced in this work that it bored him. For an instant, it seemed as if a thick jet of glistering gastric acid erupted from his mouth. But recognizing the smell, Sanjay turned his head to follow the stream of hornet-killing insecticide to its origin. Only 5'4", 100 pounds, wet and no doubt cold, Tanuja seemed to be a towering menace when she entered from the downstairs hall, her pretty face contorted by wrath, as if she were a terrible manifestation of Kali, goddess of death and destruction, minus two of Kali's four limbs, a can of spectricide held at arm's length. The highly pressurized container did not provide a spray, but instead produced a thick stream that projected up to 20 feet from the nozzle. Ironically, it was Link Crossley who had once mentioned that wasp spray and bear repellent were effective home defense weapons. The first man, gagging on the insecticide and unable to get his breath because of the volatile fumes, stumbled toward the kitchen sink, perhaps to rinse out his mouth, which would make things worse. Lithe as a dancer, Tanuja pivoted toward Lincoln Crossley, who reached for the pistol on the counter, and she triggered the can again. At a distance of only 8 feet, the stream splattered forcefully into his eyes and nose, rendering him temporarily blind and in even greater respiratory distress than her first target. As the man in white gloves cursed and dropped the ampule with the hypodermic, Sanjay slid out of his chair and under the table and onto his hands and knees to get out of the line of fire. Now, all three of the men were wheezing, coughing, issuing wordless cries of misery, colliding with furniture and one another. Pushing between steel-legged chairs, crawling out from under the table, Sanjay heard his sister call his name. He saw her at the door between the kitchen and garage, which was when gunfire erupted. The glass window in the microwave shattered. A round ricocheted off the refrigerator. An upper cabinet door pocked and cracked, and the dishes within exploded in a rattle-jangle of shrapnel. If not blinded, with tears and insecticide flooding down his face, Link Crossley must have seen a world blurred beyond all recognition. He drew breath in raw gasps, exhaling explosively as each inhalation contained more suffocating flatus than air, swaying in place as if his legs were rubberizing. Yet he held fast to the pistol, firing at phantoms evoked by his stinging, bloodshot eyes. Crawling frantically, Sanjay stayed wide of the gloved intruder, who was lying on his right side, bearded with vomit. Hands clutching his stomach, the man now foamed at the mouth as though rabid. The guy who had been by the mudroom door, having taken a few ounces of the hornet-killing concoction straight in the mouth and having reflexively swallowed it, sprawled on his back, clawing his throat with such urgency that his fingernails scratched bloody furrows in his flesh, perhaps desperate for air, perhaps poisoned and dying. Beside him lay a smartphone, which must have slipped out of a jacket pocket when he fell. Although frantic to escape the kitchen and the blind man's Hail Mary gunfire, Sanjay had the presence of mind to confiscate the phone on his way to the open door through which Tanuja had vanished. After dogging it into the laundry room, where his sister had put down the spectricide and waited at the entrance to the garage, Sanjay clambered to his feet. In his terror, he heard himself praise her with a Hindi expression of their dad's, "Shabash," which meant well done. Switching on the phone as he followed Tanuja into the garage, he said, "I'll call 911. "Screw that," she said. "We're out of here." 7. Now confident that it wouldn't be thrown at her, Jane poured a second mug of coffee, brought it to the table, and put it in front of Sarah Holdsteck, the fragrant steam rising in serpentine ribbons. As she refreshed her own mug, she said, "Though you've agreed to help me, first there's more you need to hear." "Which must mean my situation is even worse than I think." "Simon never told you he'd been married 3 times before?" Sarah was surprised for a moment, and then not. "He said he'd sworn to stay a bachelor, but with me he wanted it to be forever. His third wife said he has a silver tongue." "Yeah, and a heart of iron." Jane returned the Pyrex pot to the coffee maker. "He seems to choose his wives for 2 reasons. First, they resemble one another. Slim brunettes with blue eyes, 5'6", give or take an inch." "The other qualification?" "Money. They inherited it, or earned it, as in your case and another. Not enormous fortunes, but serious money. 3 other wives with 4 different divorce attorneys. Yet in every case, they wanted zip from Simon, while giving him 50-70% of their assets. After going through one hell or another." In her chair again, Jane said, "Pretty much the same hell. People sued them. All kinds of federal agencies suddenly came after them, and at the height of the chaos, ice-cold baths, or the equivalent, and a dose of intense humiliation." "They all broke, like me," Sarah intuited, not as if she thought the weakness of the three previous wives somehow exonerated her, but as if depressed by the news of Simon's repeated triumphs. "Count yourself lucky or wise that you gave him what he wanted after a weekend of abuse. Anyway, your only other choice would have been to kill him." "I wish I had. But I was a different person then. So timid." "Not timid," Jane said. "Naive. His third wife endured 8 days. Ice water baths, brutal sessions in a superheated sauna, sleep deprivation. And then came the vicious gang rapes you escaped. 3 men at a time and never the same 3. She broke. She lives simply now on what he allowed her to keep. She's become agoraphobic, so afraid of the outside world she never leaves her little bungalow." When Sarah drank some coffee, the mug rattled against her teeth. "I don't know what outrages the other two wives were subjected to," Jane said. "But even with his first, Simon didn't need her money. He was already an entrepreneur with a few highly profitable businesses, largely because of his connections with people in positions of power." Sarah folded her hands around the warm mug and closed her eyes, and seemed to be listening to the torrents of rain pummeling the house. But perhaps instead, she heard only moments of the past, her ex-husband's sneering voice. "In time," she said, "I always knew my money was the least of it. What mattered most to him was my total mortification, my shame, my submission. That's why I think he let me live. So he can know I'm out here, changed forever and suffering." Because Sarah was smart enough to understand the implications of 2 final revelations, Jane gave her facts without interpretation. 2.5 years after the divorce, his first wife treated herself to a vacation in France, accompanied by her cousin. On their 3rd day in Paris, both women disappeared. Their remains were found 2 days later, in an abandoned building in an arrondissement where they would never have dared to go, where even police are reluctant to patrol because of the Iranian and Syrian gangs that operate there. They'd been robbed and beaten to death with lengths of iron pipe left at the scene. In the case of his second wife, 3 years after the divorce, she'd recovered enough confidence to have a boyfriend. They went hiking in Yosemite. At a point where the trail narrowed with a steep drop to one side, maybe one of them slipped over the edge. Maybe the other reached out to halt the companion's fall and was pulled off balance. However it happened, both ended up dead on the rocks 300 feet below. Sarah seemed to want the coffee only for the warmth that the mug imparted to her hands. "So I've got 6 months to a year. Unless I kill him in self-defense, or someone else kills him because of the information I'm able to pry out of him. I already agreed to help you." "I know," Jane said. "I've told you this only because I want you to get more serious about carrying that concealed pistol, about your security system, about your life, and how fragile it remains." 8. The rising garage sectional, like a mausoleum door setting free those who had been thought dead and entombed, the sudden cataracts of rain against the windshield, the wild night of shaken trees and wet whirling leaves and wind-worked forms of mist galloping out of the west, all of it now became a celebration of life. Behind the wheel of the Hyundai Santa Fe Sport, Sanjay Shukla was intoxicated by their escape, but also harrowed by the recent violence, as he accelerated toward the distant gate that would swing open automatically at his approach. He switched on the headlights. "Lights off!" Tanuja cried with such conviction that he obeyed without question. "They blocked the driveway with their SUV." "So we popped the brake, shifted into neutral, push it aside. But there might be a 4th son of a bitch with it." "Shit." Sanjay wished he'd thought to take the poisoned man's gun instead of his smartphone. Simultaneously, he and his sister declared, "The horse gate!" Sanjay swung the Hyundai off the pavement, left onto the front yard, and rollicked across the uneven lawn, which had been an unmown meadow of tall grass in the days when their father had kept horses. The equine gate on the south side of the property had been a second construction entrance during the building of the house. It was wide enough for a vehicle. A simple hinged section of fencing gave access to a riding trail that wound through the eastern hills. In the gloom, the great black limbs of the spreading oaks were unmoved by the storm, but the willowy branchlets whipped the night and cast off beetle-shaped leaves that skittered across the windshield and were flung into flight by the wipers. The land sloped down, and below them, like the sunken ramparts of some lost city, the faint white boardwork of the ranch fencing welled out of the watery darkness. Sanjay braked, intending to get out and release the gate, but Tanuja threw open her door, got it, and plunged into the rain. As Sanjay watched her ghosting through the murk, Tanuja seemed small, childlike, as though the night was shrinking her, his Chotti Benji, his little big sister. Suddenly, he feared losing her for the first time since they'd escaped the clutches of Ashima and Bert Chatterjee to become emancipated minors by order of the court. For the 7 years prior to that, they had been two against the world, and so they appeared to be again, inexplicably. For fraternal twins, they were remarkably alike, slender but athletic, with glossy black hair and eyes darker still. Both were talented guitarists. Both were unbeatable bridge players at 14, but grew bored with cards at 18, when their writing began to consume them. She would marry one day, and perhaps so would he, and while he'd be happy for her, on the day that they parted he would feel as though he'd been cleaved in half. The gate swung open, and Tanuja returned to the Hyundai. Sanjay drove into the rugged land where the horse trail promised adventure for the equine gentry to which their parents had once belonged. He turned downhill, toward the county road, light still off, hoping the thousand voices of wind and water would mask their engine noise, in case a guard remained in the SUV at the main gate. "They were going to inject me. You too, if they found you."
"I saw the syringe. But inject with what?" she asked.
"With nothing good."
"With this, whatever it is," she said, revealing two of the sleeves of silvery insulation that contained ampules, which she had evidently snatched off the table while Sanjay was crawling under it. He said,
"It's crazy. Link Crossley being with them."
"It's just as crazy without him." The land sloped gently westward. A narrowing of the horse trail bracketed them with weeds that tapped and scraped at the vehicle, as if, with brittle fingers, the resurrected residents of an ancient burial ground were protesting this intrusion on sacred soil.
"Could Ashima and Bert be part of this?" Tanuja wondered.
"What would they have to gain?"
"What little they didn't already steal from us. And revenge."
"Not after 8 years.
They're lucky they avoided prison, and they know it."
Out of the rain and fog and formless dark, order appeared as two parallel lines. At first pale, perhaps illusory, they acquired reality, crisp edges. The double white line defining the center of the county road. The slope terminated in the flat expanse of blacktop. Sanjay turned left, away from their house and the SUV that blocked access to it. He braked at once, however, because a Range Rover stood across both lanes, leaving too little room to drive past it either fore or aft. The headlights were not on, but the blinkers silvered the falling rain in front of it and bloodied the rain behind. Doors opened, and two men got out of the vehicle, shadowy figures, solemn and methodical and unhurried, like those who had forced their way into the house. Sanjay shifted into reverse, backed up at speed, wheeled hard right, fishtailed the Hyundai 180 degrees, braked, shifted into drive, switched on the lights, and fled north, past the SUV blocking their driveway. The road dead-ended in a turnaround, where the fall-off from the pavement was so gentle that there were no guardrails.
They have all-wheel drive like we do,
Tanuja warned.
But maybe not nerve enough,
Sanjay said as they crossed the graveled shoulder and angled down a weeded slope, broom straw and brambles shredding against the undercarriage. The mist thickened in the realm below, borne out of the depths, and in its ascent was shaped by the wind into